From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. African-American entrepreneurs are being shortchanged when it comes to doing business in Cincinnati, Ohio, according to the local branch of the NAACP. It's been reported that less than 2% of city contracts in 2007 went to black-owned businesses, even though Cincinnati is 47% African-American. This has once again called into question the issues of race relations in the city. And to discuss this further, I'm joined now by Christopher Smitherman. He is president of the NAACP in Cincinnati. And in a moment, we will hear from the city's mayor, Mark Mallory. Mr. Smitherman, welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cox.
I quoted some figures from a 2007 survey conducted by the City of Cincinnati Small Business Enterprise Program, but the question really is, why are black businesses not being included in these contracts? And before you answer, everyone, including the mayor, who we'll speak to in just a moment, agrees that the numbers are bad, but some say the city is hampered in its efforts after losing a lawsuit by the Ohio Contractors Association over its minority-specific program. Is that right?
No, that's not. In 2002, Mr. Cox, the city of Cincinnati did a disparity study, and that disparity study is on our website, which is www.naacpcincinnati.org. And that disparity study in 2002, and that was right after the riots that we had in the city of Cincinnati, that some in the African-American community, including myself, define it as the uprising in our community, showed that the city of Cincinnati was engaging in what we call economic apartheid. And from that disparity study, the city could have easily and still today could leverage remedies based on the data that came from that disparity study in 2002. What has been so frustrating for the Cincinnati NAACP, Mr. Cox, is that in this time period, we now have an African-American mayor. And you are correct that the city of Cincinnati is 47% African-American. So when we look at numbers where the city spent $60 million on construction and one African-American business received $51,916, in another area that we call professional services, where the city spent $146 million in professional services, those are your lawyers, your accountants, your stockbrokers. 134 contracts were extended and zero went to African-American businesses.
Now, let me ask you this, sir. Who is responsible for this, in your opinion? Is it the mayor? Is it the city council? Or do you think perhaps both or someone else?
It is the strong mayor. The buck stops with the mayor. He has hired the city manager, who is also African-American. And this is what is making our plight across the country getting more and more difficult, because our elders fought so hard for us to get a seat at the counter, breaking down the physical barriers. Now African-Americans are able to sit at the counter, Mr. Cox, but we have no money in our pocket to buy the pancakes because we have no jobs.
Can you explain why you feel that the mayor, but since especially given the fact that he is African-American, would not be in support of what of the business community, the black business community in Cincinnati?
Well, when we look at the 07 numbers, Mr. Cox, which is a key point, this month, in the 2008 numbers are due out. So we're talking about the 07 numbers, and in a week, we're going to have the 2008 numbers. And we believe that those 2008 numbers are going to look as bad as the 2007 numbers. That means that the administration saw the 07 numbers and took no corrective action going into 2008. And why we're talking about it so much now is we see the federal government sending millions of dollars right now through the city of Cincinnati, through the stimulus package. And again, African-Americans and African-American businesses are on the outside looking in.
Here's my final question for you, and our time is running short. What do you want to happen? What do you want the mayor to do, the city council to do now?
There are shovel-ready projects right now. We have the Dorian Project, which is located in a community called Mount Auburn, led by an African-American developer that the city council and the mayor have been stonewalling doing business with her. We have a Lincoln Project right here in the heart of an African-American community that's been sitting since 1980 unfinished. Finish the project and put African-Americans to work. But we can't accept anymore that we don't have the capacity, sir. We have the capacity. We have the professionals. What we need now is a level playing field. And I think it's very disingenuous for the mayor, for city council or the city manager to say that in a city that is 47% African-American, that the African-American business is getting 1.6% of $665 million or $269,000 is acceptable.
Mr. Smitherman, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you so much for your time.
That was Christopher Smitherman, president of the NAACP in Cincinnati. He joined us from the studios of WGUC in Cincinnati. Joining me now to answer some of those questions raised by Mr. Smitherman is the mayor of Cincinnati, Mark Mallory. Mr. Mayor, welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you. Glad to be on as a guest.
Now, as you just heard, we talked about, we reported the fact that not quite $300,000 went to African-American businesses in 2007. That's out of $656 million that were awarded to the city. So my question is, sir, does that figure concern you, and what is your explanation for why it is so out of proportion?
Well, that number concerns me greatly. Of course, being the mayor of the great city of Cincinnati, I want to be in a position where we're providing opportunities for as many people as possible. But as we look at those numbers, we have to understand the complete picture, and I'm not sure that that report presents a complete picture.
And what is the complete picture?
Having said that, it is important to point out that we in this city of Cincinnati are dealing with a lawsuit that challenged our minority business enterprise program. We have been defending our position, which is that we should be able to have a minority business enterprise program in the city of Cincinnati. We spent about $500,000 in legal fees so far. We're probably going to spend another $500,000, and we're going to continue to vigorously defend our position. Because we do think it's important that as many people as possible have opportunities, particularly African-Americans, within our city.
Let me ask you, Mr. Mayor, is that lawsuit the reason that more contracts have not been awarded to African-Americans? I'm sure you heard Mr. Smitherman say that that was not the reason.
The lawsuit is the reason that we are not able to have a minority business enterprise program. We have in place a small business enterprise program. And keep in mind that when I talk about the lawsuit and the placement of these programs, these things happened prior to my service as mayor. As a matter of fact, Mr. Smitherman was on city council at the time that these things would have transpired. But I'm not here to make excuses. That's not what this is about. We've got to make sure that we're putting into place as many opportunities as we can. Let me tell you some of the things that we're doing to ensure that African-Americans are going into business and being successful. We have an effort called Shop 52, which is all about getting to minorities, women, and veterans, and making sure that they know what business opportunities are available to them, that they receive the assistance of the city, local financial institutions, business organizations, and service organizations.
Well, let me interrupt you, Mr.
So that they can go into business and be successful.
Well, let me interrupt you to just say this. What good does that do, sir, if these people are not awarded any of the contracts that are let?
Well, we are working to ensure that we have a process in place that is fair, that is equitable, and that people have access to. Shop 52 is one of the ways that people can learn exactly how to go about being successful in bidding for contracts with the city of Cincinnati.
Here's my final question.
Keep in mind that this is a bidding process. So, it's a competitive process that people go through. And Christopher Smitherman's brother went through the process on our banks project. We've extended contracts so far, about four contracts of the $600 million that we're going to be spending down there. And his brother got one of the contracts in excess of $200,000.
Now, let me just end this by asking, for clarity's sake, that even with the contracts that have been let, the percentage of minority business entrepreneurs who are getting a part of this pie is still in the 1% range. Is that correct, sir?
It is terrible. That percentage is terrible, and that's why we're taking action steps to ensure that that number increases. I'm going to be appointing a special task force, which will report back to me and to the city council, that will take direct action to make sure that we get those numbers up, that we change those dynamics, that we inform people about the process, that the process works, that we have a clean tracking system, and that we're doing the outreach that makes the awarding of these projects and these bids and contracts the most successful that we can possibly see.
And, you know, as new money comes in through the stimulus package from the White House, you're hoping, I'm assuming, and I need just a yes or no for this, that you will be able to increase the numbers of black business participation in those shovel-ready projects.
We're going to look for every opportunity to do that.
Sir, thank you very much. That was Mark Mallory. He is the mayor of the city of Cincinnati. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. From gritty streets of Baltimore to the seedy underbelly of Los Angeles, few literary genres capture the imagination better than crime fiction. There are crooks, private eyes, and of course, some dames as well. Crime fiction brings the bad guys to our backyards, and today, as part of our ongoing series on crime, we bring you the finest in African-American crime writers. Paula Woods joins us now to start off this conversation. We'll be joined by some others in just a moment. She's the author of the Charlotte Justice Mystery Series and the editor of Spook, Spies, and Private Eyes, an anthology of African-American crime fiction. Hi, Paula.
Hi, Tony.
It's nice to have you here.
Thanks.
Crime fiction is often about death and the seedy underbelly of society, and your book, Spook, Spies, and Private Eyes, gives a cross-section of African-American crime fiction writers. In what way would you say, Paula, that African-American crime fiction writers make the genre their own?
I think one of the things that I always admired about what people like Walter Mosley, Gar Haywood, Gary Phillips, and others do is that they really tell us what it's like to live in black America. When black crime fiction was first written, going back to 1900, it was always about a different part of society that we didn't see. And so for African-American readers, it was seeing yourself validated through the culture. It wasn't necessarily always about the crime. It was also about the culture. And for whites, it was like a little peek under the kimono. You know, you got to see Harlem in Rudolph Fisher, or you got to see Walter Mosley's 1940s L.A., or you got to see Charlotte Justice's Los Angeles in the 90s. So it was always something different and a different aspect of life that we didn't see before.
Yeah, but how did it change from, say, a Chester Himes to a Mosley to to Gar, Anthony Haywood? How has it changed, that storytelling and looking under the cover, so to speak?
Well, you know, I think Chester Himes was as much caricature in some regards as it was a look at the culture. Walter Mosley, when his books came out in the early 90s, were much more inside black culture from a reality standpoint. And I think the same is true of Gar. I think the early writers were much more stylized. Mm-hmm. And I think the current crop of writers are much more realistic.
Well, let's talk to some of those current crop of writers who are joining us in the studio. With us right now, we're joined by Gar Anthony Haywood. He is the Seamus Award-winning author of the Aaron Gunner series, and Gary Phillips, who writes and edits crime and mystery stories. His latest graphic novel, High Rollers, is about an L.A. gangster. Gentlemen, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Tony.
Gar, let me start with you. There are many different forms of writing out there. You chose crime. What kind of research do you do before you start writing?
It depends on the story, Tony, of course. I try to do as much as is necessary to make the story believable, mm-hmm. as opposed to quote-unquote realistic. You know, I was fortunate enough to start writing in the age of the Internet, where it's a relatively simple thing to get on the net and Google something and come up with a ton of material. you know, for my protagonists, Aaron Gunner specifically, there isn't a whole lot of research necessary other than all the reading I've done within the genre. Mm-hmm. And my own personal experience, my life experiences. Sure. You know, I'm not one of those writers that, you know, will say that my characters are not in some way similar to myself. A lot of Gunner's attitudes and such come from my own. And so in that respect, research doesn't really come into the equation very much. Mm-hmm. Gunner is myself in another profession. And, you know, I try not to overplay research too much. But I definitely think that you have to do enough so that the reader believes what he's reading.
So it has some credibility, obviously. Gary, you grew up in South Los Angeles, and your graphic novels take place here in the City of Angels. What makes this such a good place for crime noir?
Well, I guess the old adage is that L.A. in particular is a place where people come to reinvent themselves for various reasons, for good and for ill. And of course, it's prickling below the surface of that, or it's prickling into their lives before they got here, and their lives they've now kind of manufactured for themselves while they're here. That leads to this kind of rich soil, I think it is, to tell these crime and mystery stories. I write both novels and comic books and graphic novels, so I get to play with the form a lot, and it's really great for me to kind of go back and forth between prose and being able to tell stories with words and pictures.
Well, Paula, is there such a thing as a geography to the culture of writing black crime fiction?
There are many geographies, because if you think about some of the writers, they wrote about the black underclass. And so there's that geography. In other writers' work, in Stephen L. Carter, for example, or in the Charlotte Justice series, they write about the black elite. So the geography can be class. It can be geography like L.A. I mean, L.A. is blessed, I think, to have the greatest concentration of black crime writers anywhere in the country. I don't know if you guys have thought about that, but, you know, there are more of us here than anywhere else.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Is that true? Have you guys thought about that? Why is that? Not just because the weather's better either, right?
That might have something to do with it, Tony.
I don't know. Gary, you want to take that one?
I don't know, because I tell you what, I can't write when it's really too cold. I'm going to tell you that now. or I'm worried about paying the heating bill. But maybe it does, you know, following this thread of, well, partly, of course, we know that this is where the movies are, so, of course, people are attracted to that, and they come here for that. I was actually, funny enough, I was just thinking as people were talking, it's interesting to note that there's a couple of antecedents, I suppose they are, ancestors to where we're at today. And in particular, I was thinking of Joe Nazelle. Joe Nazelle was who passed, I guess, about a year and a half or 2 years ago.
Yeah,
and
Joe was one of my teachers.
There we go. Yeah. There we go. And a lot of people probably haven't heard of Joe Nazelle because, as we know, he wrote all of his work were paperback originals for a small Holloway house here, which still exists here in town. But funny enough, I was thinking of his work particularly because they were crime novels and they were set in the 70s. Here in Los Angeles, Street Wars, The Wolves, etc. Mm-hmm. So there is a kind of interesting, ancestry there to like the black crime writing of today.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. And Joe Nazelle was also a journalist.
That's correct.
Yes,
so
he was.
He was a colleague of mine as well.
Yeah.
Let me ask: Do you think that publishers have more of an appetite, Gar, for these kinds of books from black authors than perhaps other types of books written by blacks?
That hasn't been my experience, Tony. not recently, anyway.
Let me show you my 7-book contract.
That's right.
Okay.
And Mason from Haywood, tell them we're not here.
No, I think that the way that publishing is changing, and not for the better lately, that probably authors of color, within or without genre, are feeling the crunch probably more than anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I just received a rejection for the manuscript that my agent is presently trying to sell and has been trying to sell for going on 2 years.
Hmm.
And this rejection letter or email was very, very positive about what they liked about the book. They seemed to love everything about it, but the note of the rejection was essentially that the main character's life experience was not universal enough for the size of the the audience that they would want to attract.
So what does that mean, Paula? How do you interpret that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I find in publishing that when it comes to publishing in African Americans, there's always the one. So when Bill Clinton said that Walter Mosley was one of his favorite writers, he became the one.
That was it.
And when you talk about black literary fiction, Toni Morrison is the one. And I think publishing tends to do that. And we had a day. There was a time in African American fiction in general that there were multiple voices. But as the economy gets more and more compressed, you find that they're looking for, well, who's the one that's going to sell the most books? And so it tends to diminish the number of opportunities for writers. And then you have other things that come in. I think, like right now, there's this preoccupation with Indian culture. So you'll find a lot of Indian writers who publishers, New York based publishers, are all excited about because, like, they're the new ones. Mm. That's okay. The one we don't know. It's the exotic. And I think whether our experiences are universal enough or exotic enough, there's always a line you're trying to walk with other people who are evaluating whether what you're writing about is authentic enough or universal enough.
Well, let's talk about the actual genre itself, the book, the storyline, the protagonist, the conflict, things like that. For people who like that type of book, and I'm one. You get into a good crime novel, and you just can't put it down. You carry it with you everywhere you go, in the purse, in the car, in your pocket. And any time you sit down and you catch 2 or 3 minutes, you're going to flip through a few pages.
Right.
What is it about that style, Gary, of writing? What is it that you put in there that keeps readers turning the page?
Well, of course, that's what every writer hopes for, that the reader will, as you said, Tony, not put that book down and be absorbed by it and be carried away in that story. But I think it always gets back to, in any kind of writing, in the genre or outside of the genre, it's always about the characters. It really is. It really gets down to, I think, the psychology of the people that you, these two-dimensional or three-dimensional, hopefully, characters that you try to make live on the page, that they come to life for you, and hopefully they come to life for the reader. Now, obviously, also crime novels in particular, they're always about the weird twists and turns of the crime, particularly in the noir bent. That is to say, in a noir novel, you know that things are not what they seem. Mm-hmm. You also know that these characters are out for themselves. That somebody's going to backstab or betray somebody else, and I think, you know, it's partly it just sort of gets to that part of us in human nature. I think you kind of wait for that to happen, you wait for that to come, and the trick is to make it fresh, to make it seem kind of new and exciting. Because in the end, and maybe it was Raymond Chandler who said this. I'm not sure who said it. It might have even been Shakespeare. But there's really only 6 or 7 plots.
Mm-hmm. And now, does it matter in terms of A, writing the story, B, marketing the story, whether the protagonist in a crime novel is male or female, Gar?
Certainly not at this point. I mean, once upon a time, of course, there probably was a prejudice toward the male character, but that doesn't exist anymore. If anything, it's completely the reverse. But okay. I agree completely with what Gary said, that the draw of a book, almost any type of book, is in the character. If you believe these people and if they seem three-dimensional to you and their experiences are interesting and fascinating in some way, you know, that's what's going to keep someone reading. I think the other thing, too, specific to the mystery or crime genre, and I've said this many times in answering this particular question, I think that the attraction of the mystery novel is that typically the bad guys don't get away. The bad guys get what's coming to them. So, for instance, if I were to feature Bernard Madoff in the next book,
we know how that would end.
He's
then,
dead by
we?
Page
okay.
three.
That would end. Then it's just about finding the money.
Let me ask you, because Paula's eyebrows seem to go up on the issue of the gender protagonist. At the statement that you made that you think that perhaps it's reversed now, do you see it that way?
Yes and no. I can think of isolated writers, Patricia Cornwall or Sue Grafton, who have a huge following for their female protagonists. But I find, in general, I think it's the male protagonists that are moving the plots. Because if the guy is interesting enough, the men are going to want to read him. And if he's sexy enough, the women want to read him too.
Also, there's something to that, because I think that the stereotype that people who read these kinds of books, myself included, you're looking for a good storyline, but you're also looking for some violence, and
right.
you're looking for
right.
some sex.
Right, absolutely.
Is that not right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I have a, formula chart right above my computer.
Well, you know, it's funny. When I wrote the first Charlotte Justice book, Inner City Blues, there's this sex scene in it. And frankly, as I was writing, I was like, I got to get through all this plot, and you know, I got to get some sex in here. I got to have some sex in this book. And so I wrote the chapter, and then wrote my way up to it. Today, still, I have people say, you know, there was that one part of that book that I just really liked, and wouldn't you go write that again?
We know what part that was.
Yeah.
Let me bring the conversation to a close with this question. Do you read other crime writers? And if you do, is there a danger in doing that as a writer yourself? Mm. Gary.
Yeah. Well, the danger is you don't want to outrightly or overtly steal somebody else's plot, particularly if they're a friend of yours, because you're going to invariably see them and they're going to be pissed off about that.
You're right.
My normal routine is that if I'm in the middle of a book or I'm in the middle of writing a comic book script or just a general script, I will avoid reading anybody, any kind of crime or mystery story, because I don't want to crib from it. I don't consciously crib from it. But of course, invariably, all this stuff is like bubbling up in your head. I mean, one of my favorites, and you wouldn't necessarily see it in my work, was a crime writer or mystery writer named Ross McDonald, who wrote very evocative stories, but very, very minimal on violence and sex in his stories, but really about the inward journey of his characters. He was very influenced by sort of Freudian things, and it was very plays out a lot in his books. But so invariably, I will probably return to his work as a kind of anchor and a kind of stationing point. But I will consciously, as I said, sort of avoid reading the people that I know or books that are in circulation now until I've finished. And then, of course, I'll take some relaxation time.
Really quickly, Garv, I've got about 10 seconds for you to answer this.
I will say I agree with Gary completely, but I will say that if you're conscious of reading only the best, then if it has an influence on your writing, it's all for the good. There's nothing wrong with that. And by the way, you talked about Bill Clinton being a big fan of Walter Moses. I just wanted to announce officially on NPR today that I have dibs on 44.
That's what you think.
All right. Unfortunately, our time is up. This has been a great conversation. I appreciate all of you coming in. We'd like to have you come back. Bring books with you. When you come back.
Absolutely.
Gar Anthony Haywood is the author of the Aaron Gunner series. Gary Phillips writes and edits crime and mystery stories. His latest graphic novel is High Rollers. And Paula Woods is the author of the Charlotte Justice series. All three of them join me here in the studios of NPR West. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes.
Harlem. Music legends, poets, artists, and revolutionaries once walked these streets. But today, these streets belong to me and my crew.
That was the introduction to BET's new reality series, Harlem Heights, which premiered this week. The show's premise, 8 young African-Americans in their late 20s offer a glimpse into their lives as they make the leap into adulthood. A budding magazine editor, an up-and-coming lawyer, and a future politico round out the Harlem crew. The show was seen as a departure from many of the other reality shows which seek to depict black life in less positive ways. Joining me now is Lee Davenport, story editor for Harlem Heights. Lee, welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what the story editor does. I don't know that people really understand what your job is.
Well, story producer, actually. My job is to really get a hold of who these people are. You know, it is reality. They are real people. They have things going on in their lives. And so our job is to see what is going on, to know, you know, what's going to be most interesting, what's going to be most impactful, and to make sure we're capturing those moments on screen. We're not following them 24 hours a day, so oftentimes we have to know ahead of time. time, you know, if they're doing something that's going to be story worthy, to make sure we're there to capture that moment.
All right, let's listen to a bit of the premiere after Ashley surprises her former boyfriend, Brooke, by extending an invitation to her birthday party.
Okay, so maybe I'll go for like an hour if you guys come with me and come together. Like, we're not meeting there. We're going to come together.
Okay,
that's fine with me.
That wasn't hard to do.
All right. So does anybody know what Ashley's going to wear so I can wear it better?
Whatever you wear is going to be better.
Brooke, that's not nice.
She knew those were the risks when she decided to invite me, right?
I'm chuckling because I wasn't sure if that was Harlem or the San Fernando Valley in terms of some of those voices. But here's my question for you, Lee. And I think a lot of people have this question. How much of a reality television show is scripted? How much of the dialogue is real and how much of it is directed or prepackaged?
All of the dialogue is real. There's no such thing as say this line like this. We never, ever do that. Obviously, there's times where, you know, maybe the cast has had a conversation and we weren't there. So we'll need them to have a conversation for us. But we're never telling them what to say. We're never instructing them how they should feel. It's always, you know, just we need to hear what you think about this. And whatever they think and whatever they say is completely theirs.
Now, when many people think of black reality shows, let's be honest, names like Flavor of Love, I Love New York, Real Housewives of Atlanta, and there are others, many others, that come to mind, being Bobby Brown. And those shows aren't strangers to criticism. I know you know this. So why do you think Harlem Heights is different?
Well, I mean, the show is different because we're just showing regular, professional, educated black people doing their thing. You know, at some point, the premise of the show is that being smart and being educated and being successful should not be irregular. That shouldn't be the norm. It shouldn't be the exception to the Flavor Flavs and the Bobby Browns. It should be expected to be seen, and that's what we're hoping we accomplish with Harlem Heights.
So now, the ultimate question then, Lee, I suppose, is this. What you're saying notwithstanding, is it interesting enough to watch?
We think so. I mean, we've had nothing but extremely positive feedback, even with some of the criticism people are saying that they're still watching. Human beings are interesting. I mean, that's why reality TV does so well. Just people are interesting and people are fascinated by other people's lives. The cast is extremely, extremely dynamic. They're beautiful to look at. And there are interesting people that are doing fantastic things, and we really hope that that will be enough that people will watch.
What goes into selecting the cast? How do you decide who and what you want in a cast member to be on a show like this one?
Well, you obviously, the most important thing is you want someone who's very comfortable being themselves. You don't want to get cast members who want to fit a certain mold or who think they're playing a part. And so we wanted people who were who they were and unapologetic about being, you know, a law student and an entertainment reporter, or being the fashionista who maybe has an attitude but is one of the most talented up-and-coming fashion designers you'll ever see. You know, we wanted to get people who were doing what they were doing and were not going to be afraid to get on camera and be as complex as being as shallow as saying something about what someone's going to wear, but also giving back to the community and, you know, really exposing that they're just grounded people.
I'm going to put you on the spot just a little bit, Lee. How important is the look, how they look, the people that you select to be in the cast? What do you want them to look like?
Well, obviously, people like to see attractive people, but no one was selected or not selected based on appearance. That didn't happen. We were actually very lucky that we just ended up with a very pretty and, you know, well-groomed, attractive cast. It was really just kind of a fortunate blessing, but there was certainly not go out and find someone who looks better or go out and someone that has such and such appearance. That was never the mandate.
All right, tell us again the name of the show.
It is Harlem Heights.
All right, and it's on BET.
Yes, at 10 p.m. on Monday.
All right, good luck with it.
Thank you so much.
Okay, Lee, thank you for joining us. That was Lee Davenport, the story producer, actually, for Harlem Heights. As she said, the show airs on Monday nights on BET. It's Thursday, which means it's time to talk sports with our very own sports wunderkind, none other than New York Times sports columnist Bill Roden. What's up, Bill?
The great Tony Cox wunderkind.
Listen,
funny guy.
Manny. He's really gone Hollywood, Bill, I guess you could say, dragging out what coulda, shoulda been a simple deal to return to the Dodgers months ago. Instead, he and agent Scott Boras and Dodger owner Frank McCourt and GM Ned Colletti strung their poor fans along all this time. And just like that, Manny rides in on a white horse and some stringy braids to save the day.
We actually flew in. And what happened was that, you know, Boras was talking to McCourt, the owner. And, you know, McCourt said very earnestly, listen, you know, we really want Manny not just to be part of the team, but we really want him to be part of the community. And Boras said, stop. I think you need to tell that to Manny. So Manny got on the plane. He came in, flew in, and they had a great face-to-face. And, you know, Manny sort of said, listen, yeah, I know that I've got to do a little more. I've got to do a little better. And I think it was a great healing kind of, not healing, but, you know, conversation. And, you know, Manny is very comfortable in L.A. He's in a place where he's got a great fan base. They love him. And so I think it's going to be a very powerful thing. Injuries notwithstanding, Tony, I mean, I think that you guys are going to be in for a really, really special season. I think the Dodgers are going to be tougher. They're going to be better. And Manny's going to really be engaged.
Well, they need some pitching, but that's another story. Here's a question for you.
You want to do everything?
Here's a question for you, Bill. We're in a down economy, right? So where is all of this money coming from to pay these guys these exorbitant salaries? And I'm not even thinking about Manny's $45 million over 2 years, but let's take your beloved Yankees, whose multi-million dollar payroll is bigger than some countries. Yankee stock's not traded on the exchange, is it?
No, should be. But, you know, yeah, I think the Yankees payroll is something like around $140 million or something like that. That's more than the entire, like, almost National League or something. I mean, but at the same time now, they've got to pay payroll tax. They've got to pay sort of a revenue sharing tax. And so, yeah, the system is unfair. There's no question about it. Where's all this money coming from besides you and me?
Right.
I think that there are a lot of lower pay guys who aren't getting off of contracts, who are taking cuts. In other words, you're getting it from somewhere. And the money that they're getting paid now is coming from last year. You know, that's the way baseball does. I think we will see next year, we'll begin to see the pushback in terms of the long-term contracts, where the contracts are taking a hit. But right now, as long as television is there and fans are, you know,
But are the fans going to be there? Because I'm hearing that the NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball fans, they're worried. The clubs are worried because people, season ticket holders who keep the whole thing going, they may not be re-upping the way they've been in the past.
And that's when you will see you will see the effect of that next year. You know, right now, baseball is still going on in terms of the salaries. They're going on last year's income, which was record-setting. Now, if they've got a downturn at the turnstile, you are going to see it next year. This time next year, we could be talking about some serious, you know, with shrinking, withdrawals. Who knows? You may there could be a couple teams that aren't cutting it.
That are in
and
danger.
Are talking about, yeah,
absolutely. All right, let's move on to another topic. It's March. That means the madness is about to begin, Bill. I know you love college basketball, but before we talk about who is going where in the tournament, let's talk about the tournament itself. If it works for college basketball, why in the world can it not work for college football?
I mean, you just hit just the nerve, man. I mean, I hate it. I mean, that's why I can't look at college football. We've had this conversation before. I can't look at college football because it's a farce. The way the NCAA men's basketball and women's basketball tournament is conducted is the way it's supposed to be. At the end of April, when the one team walks off with a national championship, we'll all be satisfied that, you know what, the best team won. You know, they may have got hot, but they won. They went to a trial by fire, and the best team won. That is not what you have in college football, where it's kind of heebie-jeebie and, you know, abracadabra. You know, yeah, so we can go on for hours on this.
Well, we won't do that. All right, so the South and the East seem to have the big dogs this year. Connecticut, Pitt, Duke, North Carolina. Let's not forget about Oklahoma, Memphis, and Louisville. But regular season play in college basketball is not always a harbinger of what teams will do well in the tournament. So who do you like?
Yeah. Well, I like North Carolina. And I do think, Tony, I know what you're saying. I do think the regular season is somewhat important, even if it's for positioning, it's for momentum. Who goes in with a lot of momentum? And that's what the regular season is about, going downhill and gathering momentum and hitting March Madness with a full steam ahead. I like Connecticut a lot. Not, you know, particularly since Jim O'Brien is motivated to prove that he's worth the money he's getting paid. And I like North Carolina a lot. And I always reserve two spots for teams that we aren't even discussing now that are going to be probably in the Sweet 16.
Like who? You're not sure? I know who it won't be.
But that's because they're dark horses. Well, I don't know who they are.
I know who will not be in the Final Four this time around. My beloved Bruins from UCLA, they're not going anywhere this year.
Serves them right.
They had their chance, right?
Serves them right.
One last thing before I let you get out of here. I do want to talk about the NBA because we've had a lot of movement in the last few days with Joe Smith heading to the Cavaliers, Stephon Marbury going to the Celtics. Some people think that the Celtics are, you know, a lock to repeat, at least in the Eastern Conference. But if I were in Boston, I'd be very concerned about that Ohio team. What's their name? The Cavs.
Right now, what we're talking about, Cleveland is a great team in January, February. You've got to be a great team in May, in June. And I think that it's not going to lock. It's not a lock. But I like Boston a lot, and I'm really liking L.A., but guess what?
Right.
I like Portland, too.
Portland as well. All right, I will say this, and we got to get out of here. If the Clippers can beat Boston with Mikey Moore, then, you know.
Come on.
All right, I'll leave it alone.
You don't take them. They don't take them seriously.
All right.
You can't play.
Bill Roden, we have to go. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay. Hey, Tony, it's always a pleasure.
That was Bill Roden, a sports columnist for the New York Times and author of Third and a Mile, The Trials and Triumphs of the Black Quarterback. He joined us from our studios in New York. And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Tony. How's it going?
It's going well, thank you. It sounds like our conversation about First Lady Michelle Obama's hair caused quite a stir this week.
That's right. The segment triggered a flurry of comments by listeners who had pretty strong feelings about the conversation. We'll get to those comments in a second. First, we're going to go to a letter about a story we did on Washington, D.C. trying to get a voting representative in Congress. Richard Golden in Thomasville, Georgia, wrote us this.
No, it was never intended that the District of Columbia be a state. It is a district. In theory, no one should live in D.C., only work there. Everyone should be living in or have an address in Virginia and be eligible to vote there. If there are enough people in D.C. to think that they need a vote, then shrink the D.C. and give the rest back to Virginia. And then Mary Shepard commented on another conversation I had with contributor Judge Lynn Toler that discussed if Rihanna should press charges in an alleged attack by her boyfriend, Chris Brown.
Mary wrote, Judge Toler said that it was not Rihanna's responsibility. It's the state's responsibility to press charges. President Obama himself said that this is a new era of responsibility. Of course, Rihanna has a responsibility to follow through with this situation and press charges. And by the way, since she is in the public eye, she's got an opportunity to set a strong example. Now on to the comments for the conversation NPR's Allison Samuels had with celebrity stylist Marcia Hamilton, where they talked about First Lady Michelle Obama's possible influence on how black women will style their hair. First up, Lindsay Saunders.
She wrote this on our website. I've been hoping for some black hair talk. I've recently been struggling with my hair and have decided to get rid of it. I agree with Marcia about black women in the corporate world and how hairstyles can affect people's views of you. Thanks for the coverage.
But Hallie Richardson disagrees. She wrote, I found this story to be utterly ridiculous during this economic downturn. When women are losing their jobs and fighting to keep their homes, we are advising them on spending the equivalent of a mortgage payment on a one-time service? Why not spend the time discussing alternate ways to keep your hair in good shape when money is tight?
And Detroit listener Tracy Morris sent us this. I found it sad that the story spent so much time talking about what steps to take in order to get a good weave, but didn't talk about where to go or what to do in order to get good styling options for our hair in its natural state. If we're going to get past the antiquated notion of good hair equals straight and bad hair equals kinky, then we need our community and our media, beauty magazines, etc., to promote and disseminate options and images showing the care and styling of natural hair.
And finally, Gino Civalti in St. Louis, Missouri, sent us this send-off. I'm impressed with the quality of your show as it winds down. The host is very professional and easy to listen to. The production quality has also been high. Thank you for going out in style. And thank you for writing. Please keep your thoughts coming over the next couple weeks.
To write us, just log on to NPR and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Glad you could join us. To listen to the show or subscribe to the podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for the newsletter, visit our blog, nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium.